at pajamagram.com.
Support for WPR comes from Oakwood Village Prairie Ridge. Enjoy life on the rise at this Oakwood Lutheran Senior Ministries community on Madison's East Side, offering older adults opportunities to create new friendships and pursue personal growth. Details at oakwoodvillage.net.
Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to WPR.org/mobile app to download.
Pets are an important and wonderful part of our life, aren't they? Well, at least for many of us. And not only you want them to be healthy, but you want them to be happy as well. And when there are problems with their behavior, it can be kind of stressful, both for us and for our animal companions. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have two certified applied animal behaviorists with us on the show today. Suzanne Hetz is a certified applied animal behaviorist and co-founder and president of Animal Behavior Associates Incorporated in Littleton, Colorado. Got a PhD in zoology focused on animal behavior from Colorado State University. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here today.
Oh, great to have you with us. Dan Estep is a certified applied animal behaviorist with Animal Behavior Associates as well in Littleton, and is also vice president and co-owner with Suzanne of co-owner of Island Dog Press. Dan, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. And you are married, if I'm not mistaken.
We are.
And she's the boss.
Yes.
Sometimes. Not all the time.
Okay. Oh, well, it's wonderful. And by the way, I should also mention that you are at the KJZZ and KBAQ radio stations in Tempe, Arizona. And thanks so much to those folks for helping us out today. It's just great to have you with us today. And I know you have so much information to share on your website, which is animalbehaviorassociates.com, including a whole list of common myths of animal behavior. And I thought it'd be fun to talk about some of those. Let's talk about some of those common myths.
We'd be happy to. Do you have a place you want to start, or do you want us to just dig right in?
I've got two cats. They're my daughter, my 10-year-old daughter's cats, Tiger and Coco. I get to clean their litter.
Yes.
Congratulations.
My wife feeds them, and my daughter plays with them the most. But when they meow, when cats meow at people, are they communicating like they would with other cats?
Well, that's really interesting. When you look at how cats relate to one another and communicate to each other, they do it a lot more by body postures and primarily by scents and odors than they do vocalizations. And most vocalizations that cats use with each other are to give warnings or to make each other go away. Cats don't have a lot of friendly or what behaviorists call affiliative vocalizations. And from what the behaviorists have studied, cats meow a lot more to people than they do to other cats. And it seems to be, it's kind of a learned pattern in that meows often get them what they want. And so they tend to meow more because that behavior works for them. Would you agree, Dan?
Right. And you do see more meowing out of kittens toward their mothers than you do in adults. So this may be simply a carryover from kittenhood, kind of a neotenous trait.
And what that means is behaviors that happen during infancy, but not during adulthood.
Well, I can tell you that Tiger and Coco love each other, and they play, and they groom each other, and it's sometimes quite a sight to behold. To be perfectly honest,
these two
male cats are not brothers. They're come from two different areas of the state, actually, but They have a great time together. And, there's been some talk in our household about bringing a dog in. And so that's another myth. Is it a myth? Are dogs and cats natural enemies?
Well, the answer, short answer is no. It had been assumed for a long time that this was kind of an instinctive thing, that dogs or cats being predators would automatically recognize their prey, that they didn't have to learn it. But some research that started back in the 1920s was able to show that, in fact, both of these species aren't born knowing who their food items are or even who their friends are. They have to learn that, and they learn that during a really early stage of their development, a sensitive period for socialization, we call it. And during that time, it's the time when it's easiest for cats and dogs to learn who their social partners ought to be.
Hmm.
And if you raise dogs with cats, then what happens is that they will tend to think of each other more as friends and develop more amicable kinds of relationships than if they hadn't had that early exposure.
So if you're looking to bring a dog into your house, you might ask whatever the source is of that animal, if the dog has been raised with cats or had previous experience with them, because if he hasn't, that's the type of situation that's most likely to cause problems, because as Dan said, if he hasn't been socialized to cats, then he might view them as something to eat rather than something to play with.
Yeah, or if you bring in, I suppose if you brought in a pup or a young dog.
Yes.
That could also work.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because then you've got them in that socialization period where they tend to look at everybody as friends unless proven otherwise. So they're much more readily able to learn that cats are just another thing to play with rather than something that I need to harm or hurt.
Yeah. Dogs are, I guess you'd say, denning animals. Dogs don't mind being confined in a crate. Just that could be a natural preference. That is sometimes assumed. And, if it was me, I don't know that I'd want to be crated up all day long or for a long period of time.
Well, good for you. And most dogs don't want to either. You know, that's one of my soapbox issues, and I will try to inhibit myself this morning. But when you look at how wild canids use dens, they use them to raise their young. They certainly don't spend 24/7 in their dens, and they also can leave their dens whenever they want to. So this notion that because dogs and other canids use dens means that a dog will automatically not mind being confined in a crate is just a myth. And in our considered opinion, and most of our colleagues, is that crates are really overused. I mean, they can be great for house training a dog. They can be great to keep a dog safe in the car. They can be great for short-term confinement when you're traveling. But as far as crating being a way of life, where a dog is put in a crate 7 o'clock in the morning when the owner leaves for work, doesn't get out until 5 at night except for maybe a potty break, and then is crated again at night, that's not a good quality of life for a dog.
No, I would definitely agree with that. And there's something else that kind of has bothered me a bit. I've had a close association with, a very positive association with Patricia McConnell, who you may, a certified applied animal behaviorist, who you may or may not know. She's written several books.
Oh, yes. She's a good friend of ours. We've known Trish for probably close to 30 years, and we wanted to thank her for actually giving you guys our names to come on this program. So I'm glad that you brought her up.
I brought her up because one of the things that she is definitely not in favor of is something that you see on some programs where people say, well, the best relationship with dogs is created when you are dominant over them and in that role of pack leader, and I'm not so sure that's the best way to do things.
I'll let Dan take that one because I could get off on that one as well. So I'll give him a chance to say a few things.
Dan?
Since you accuse me of being the boss, I'll let him talk. How about that?
All right. What do you think, Dan?
Well, the short answer is no. It's not the best way to have a relationship with a dog. And it's not clear where all this came from, but there were some studies that were done of captive wolves back starting in the 1940s that showed that those animals living with each other would form these dominance hierarchies, that there would be an alpha who would get access, primary access to the food and to the prime sleep spots and to the mating partners and so forth. And it was just assumed then that this was sort of the natural way that wolves lived with each other in the wild. And wolves being the ancestors of our domestic dogs, at least that's the best evidence that we have at the moment, people just assumed that if wolves behaved in this way, had these packs and alphas, then they would have the same sort of social organization as dogs. And that even when dogs lived with people, the dogs would attempt to try and form a pack and try to become dominant over people. So that was the logic that was created. It turns out that that's all based on faulty observations, that when you watch wild wolves, it's really an extended family. It's a mom and a dad and their kids over several breeding seasons that hang out together, that hunt cooperatively, and that help each other to raise the litter from the current year. So it's a really cooperative thing, and it's a dominance relationship only to the extent that any parent-child relationship is a dominance relationship. And quite frequently I'll ask my clients, I said, you know, who's the alpha in your family? You know, and are you concerned about your kids, you know, trying to become alpha? And they look at me with these quizzical looks, because it just, that sort of terminology just doesn't fit with a family kind of relationship.
And bad things have really been done to dogs, I think, in the name of, quote, trying to dominate them, being physical and confrontive and depriving them of things that they want and need. And we tell our clients to think more as your relationship with your dog is kind of a cross between a parent and a best friend. And let's go from there. Let's work cooperatively to get your dog to do what you want him to do, not be heavy-handed about the whole relationship.
Oh, I think that's a great, great, great advice. Suzanne Hetz and Dan Estep, our guests today, they're both certified applied animal behaviorists with Animal Behavior Associates Incorporated in Littleton, Colorado. Dan is also vice president and co-owner of Island Dog Press Incorporated. You can go to their website. On my Facebook page, we have a direct link to their website that's filled with lots of great information and articles. And the site, animalbehaviorassociates.com. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at animal behavior today, we looked at some common myths and ready to take some questions from you. You may have an animal behavior question. If you do, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, we always love to see those pet photos, so you can post those on the Facebook page as well. And let's turn to Nancy in Brighton next. Nancy, hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes, I have a question regarding extreme temperatures that we've been having with our dogs.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if there's any correlation to the behavior. We have two golden doodles, and one of our golden doodles is 5 years old, and she's alpha of the male. And we have a strict policy at our house that they're not allowed to be on the couches or chairs or beds or whatever. And one day, our female dog, Gigi, jumped up on the chair and a couple times, and everyone was freaking out. She was sitting right on top of the lap of one of my daughters. And then later on, she jumped up on the bed of one of my daughters when she was on the bed. And we were like, ready to call the vet and get a temperature, take her temperature. We were just really concerned at that behavior that she was doing that. Eating fine, going to the bathroom fine, no other changes, but just this desire to be with us on top of the furniture. And I was wondering if it's because we hadn't been walking her as much because of the extreme cold. She didn't get a chance to be out as much as normal. What caused behavior like that?
Okay, who wants to take a shot at that? Suzanne, you want to start?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a little hard to answer because we allow our dogs on the furniture and the bed and pretty much anywhere they want to be because those are soft surfaces that most animals really enjoy lying on. As far as it being connected to the temperature, if she's I thought that maybe she'd been outside a lot more and was trying to get warm, but then you say just the opposite, that you haven't walked her very much. So those dogs tend to be pretty active, and it may be if she hasn't been outside, she's feeling a little stir-crazy, and she's just maybe trying to do something new and different. And depending on what happens when she jumps on the bed, if you, say, yell at her or whatever, and then she jumps down, and you kind of chase her around the house screaming at her, you know, that may be the best fun she's had all day. So
She has beds, and we didn't yell at her. We just say, you know, off, because we just don't allow her to be on there. But the other thing I was wondering is, there was one, it's the behavior started the day that I let her go out, and I was distracted, and she was out for probably, I'd say, 25 minutes to half an hour, and it was a cold day. And I was wondering, could she have gotten a little hypothermia from that? And if so, would that have caused the behavior? She had none of the signs that was listed as hypothermia, but it was like she went crazy for a while, a few days, and then she was fine, and she hasn't done it again.
If she did, I don't think that would last. I mean, that can be a life-threatening condition, and if it's persisting for several days, then that's probably more behavior-related. But when dogs can tend to get clingy and want more attention or want up on furniture or to be with people more, usually there's some kind of anxiety underlying that, and it may be that she got a little freaked out by not being able to get in when she wanted to get in from that cold, and now she's just being more clingy, not wanting that to happen again. I mean, I'm speculating here.
Sure.
I don't know, Dan, did you come up with any other thoughts?
Or what they might do? Is there anything special to do, or just kind of?
I'd make it more fun to be on the floor.
Yeah. Or on their beds,
the dog beds or whatever. So really start rewarding that behavior anytime that they get on their own beds. Reward that with some petting, a little cookie, something like that, so that that becomes the desired behavior because it produces good consequences.
Mm. There you go, Nancy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Kathy and Tomahawk a chance to join in as well. Kathy, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. My dog Tucker is on my mind, and we've had him for almost 4 years. We got him when he was 6 months old. He is a rescue boy, and he'd had a very rough life, and I'll try to be brief about that, but he came to us with a label of high needs because he was so introverted and so fearful of almost anything that he encountered in his life. And he's come a long, long way, and he's a golden lab and retriever mix. And he's just a wonderful dog. We love him dearly. But there is one piece that he cannot get over, and he is totally and completely petrified of our dishwasher, if it's on or if it gets turned on. And it isn't just at my house. Our person who does a lot of dog care for us, she encounters the same thing. And, I mean, we have brought him so far in so many respects of not being afraid. I mean, when we first got him, he wouldn't stand up straight. He crawled close to the ground. So, I mean, it's been just a long walk with Tuck. But anyhow, we can't get him past this. And what he does, if he even hears it go on, I mean, my dishwasher has like 5 seconds where I can hardly hear that I turned it on. And if he hears that almost anywhere in the house, he crouches to the floor, he shakes, and it goes on. And I guess my question is, we have tried to avoid running the dishwasher. Isn't that bad? I mean, we take the dog for long walks when the dishwasher is on. We'll take him away. We plan our day around when we run our dishwasher and we go to Tuck. And, you know, we've talked about this to other people, and we've, you know, some people think that we should just make him face his fears. And when we do that, he will go and crouch to the furthest point in our house, a downstairs lower level, crawl behind the bar and be there shaking. And we're dog lovers. We hate seeing that about him.
Sure. So what do we do here? Dan, you want to start in?
Yeah. First of all, congratulations on bringing Tucker so far.
Clearly, you guys
have just done a lot of work to really help bring him out of his shell and get him over a lot of the fears that he has. So you're really to be commended for all of that. These kinds of fears are not all that uncommon, although it sounds like he's got a more extreme reaction to the sound of the dishwasher than maybe other dogs would. But we see a lot of dogs that are afraid of loud noises like dishwashers and washers and dryers and vacuum cleaners,
yeah.
And, you know, those sorts of things that'll make a lot of noise. I think the thing to do here really is not to try to force him to face his fears. There is a behavior modification technique called flooding that involves forced exposure, but it has to be done in a really careful way in order for it to work. And given the fact that it's difficult to do for most people, we tend to avoid that and really encourage people rather to try to gradually expose him to the sounds in such a way that it doesn't make him fearful. I think doing the management things that you're doing, you know, simply taking him out when the dishwasher is on, taking him out for a walk or letting him go outside, those kinds of things are fine. They help him to manage the problem, but they don't get him over the fear. And you may need to get some help from a professional to do the behavior modification to gradually get him over that fear.
Well, and here's what I might start with until they can get that help. You've already said that you take him for a walk often when the dishwasher is on. So I might start by, as soon as he hears that click, that becomes the cue that he's going to go for a walk. So it's click, you want to go for a walk, Tucker? Let's go for a walk. So that he begins to have a different feeling about that click rather than, oh my God, the sky is falling in. It's the click, I get to go for a walk, let's go. And then that accomplishes two things. It starts that counter-conditioning process, and it also does the management like you talked about. The other thing that I would do is I would use whatever equipment you have available to make a recording of your dishwasher so that you can play that back on as high of a quality sound system as you have and turn it at a very low volume and see if you can, with that that mimicking sound of the recording of the dishwasher, get it low enough so that maybe he just kind of pricks up his ears and looks a little bit apprehensive but doesn't go into his full-blown crouch or avoidance. And then you can start pairing that really low attenuated sound with some treats and other things, and you might even need to have him in another room than from where the recording is happening in order to be able to have that exposure gradual enough that he doesn't freak out at that very, very low sound of the dishwasher. So those are two starting places that I would recommend.
Yeah. Good luck, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And Betty in Wauwatosa, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, I have so been looking forward to this opportunity to talk.
Uh-oh, are we in trouble?
Oh, no. I just know that you're going to have some good advice for us. Last spring, our son was gifted with five little kitties and mom on his front porch one Sunday morning. And she stuck around for a while and took care of him, and they obviously were feral. Well, as summer turned to fall, they were brought into his home, and they're really very domesticated. They sit on your lap, they purr, and they do all these nice things. And several of them have found really lovely homes. However, my husband and I are now thinking of taking one of those precious little bundles and bringing him to our home. And we had kitties when our kids were growing up, but I haven't had a cat in the house for a while. And one of my concerns is how we can introduce him to our golden retriever, who was raised with a cat. Cat was with him for about 6 months before she died. More practically, how can we encourage him to have a lot of fun in the house without jumping up on our kitchen counters, mm-hmm. and using our furniture as a scratching board instead of his little scratching tree?
Mm. Little
well,
scratching
three,
yeah, I was going to say little scratching tea is not a good thing. Bigger scratching tree sounds better to me, but let me turn to Suzanne.
Well, before I forget, let me give you a couple of resources that we have online, and then I'll give you some specific ideas. If you go to helpingkitty.com, or you can also get it from animalbehaviorassociates.com, we have a DVD called Helping Kitty Be Good. And it talks about preventing many of the problems that you talk about. It talks about how to keep cats off of high places that you don't want them on, how to create a cat-friendly litter box, how to create a cat-friendly scratching post. But what the focus of that program is that all of the behaviors that you describe, wanting to get up on high surfaces and scratching, are normal cat behaviors. So it's much less a question of stopping the behaviors versus allowing them to happen, but just channeling them into locations that work for you and still allow the cat to get his needs met. Because cats love to be up high. And as Larry was saying, they scratch things. So the trick is to provide a scratching post that meets his behavioral needs better than the objects that you don't want him to scratch. And you may need to cover those objects with some plastic or some double-sided sticky tape temporarily until he gets in the habit of scratching the best objects that you provide him. And we go into detail in that DVD about what the characteristics of good scratching posts are, but it depends on location, it depends on texture, it depends on height, it depends on the orientation of it, and each of those characteristics needs to be evaluated in terms of his individual preferences and what he likes. So that's kind of the big picture of how you go about doing that. And the same thing with getting up on counters and furniture and that sort of thing. If you provide him with high posts or the cat trees, the cat condos, and other places in your house where it's okay to get up high, like maybe on top of the refrigerator, for example, or on top of a bookcase, and then those other places that you don't want him on, you can booby trap. And there's lots of harmless booby traps available out there, ranging from ones you can make yourself, the double-sided sticky tape being one, or on the counter, a little cookie sheet that has a little bit of water in it so that it's not real fun to jump up on the counter, to commercially available ones that emit a mist or make a loud noise. They're motion detectors that go off when the cat passes the beam. So you want to make the things that you don't want them on harmlessly unpleasant, while on the other side, meeting his needs with high locations and cat-friendly scratching posts that do meet his needs, so that you're just channeling his behaviors in the direction that you want them to go, but still meeting his needs.
We have a couple of large plants, a lime tree, actually. Limey's got about three limes on it right now, as a matter of fact, that the cats, at first, Coco loved to get into, but we put sort of crumbled up aluminum foil, put it in there. Doesn't like aluminum foil at all, so it won't go in there.
Well, and that's an example of really figuring out what a particular cat likes and doesn't like. I could easily see some cats loving to bat those little balls of aluminum around, but your cat hates them. And,
well,
and
I
so,
don't make
you know,
them balls. They're kind of long and crinkly.
Strips.
Yeah, crinkly strips. He does not like those.
And that would be another example of a harmless booby trap, so to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We had, with our other kitty, we had orange peels. That cat did not like orange peels. Mm-hmm. And if we put orange peel around a plant, he stayed far, far, far away from it. And that was more of a safety issue as much for him as it was for us not wanting him to destroy our plant.
Yeah.
But that your cat was with us for 19 years. So.
Yeah, we haven't had a cat in a couple years either, and we, just for a variety of reasons, and we've been talking about that maybe this summer is the time to add a feline back to the family, because we sure miss the presence a lot.
Yeah, and is it orange that this aroma of orange averse to many cats? I seem to remember Patricia saying that to me once.
Citruses in general.
Citrus, yeah.
Not for all cats, but for many of them. And the other question that you had about your dog, that's kind of complicated to get into right now, but as a first step, what I would start doing is just exchanging each other's scents, so that you take a towel over to your son's house and rub the kittens up with it so it has a lot of cat scent on it. You do the same thing with your dog, and then you exchange the scents so that they begin to get used to each other's scents first. And then when you bring the kitten into the house, you give him his own room for a while so that your dog and cat can hear and smell each other, but they can't see or touch one another. And again, on one of our other websites, PetProWebinars.com, we have a webinar class on demand. You can access it anytime, called The Peaceable Kingdom, that talks about how to develop good relationships between dogs and cats.
So there you go. Thank you so much for calling in, Betty. Appreciate your call. Kathy in Madison sent us an email and says, our 15-year-old daughter is interested in a career with animals and is our resident cat whisperer, as she says. How do you become an animal behaviorist? That's the question.
Well, there's a number of different routes to get there, and there's a lot more opportunities to work with animals today than there were 40 years ago when I first got interested in it. The way we, Suzanne and I and Patricia, actually, all came into it was going to graduate school in animal behavior, either through a zoology department or a psychology department, getting academically trained, and then coming out doing some apprentice work with other people who are working with behavior problems and ultimately developing our own practices. So that's one route that can be done. Also, there's a veterinary route now to become a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Behavior. It requires getting a veterinary degree and then doing a residency in behavior, much like you would any other sort of specialty. But there's also other kinds of ways that you can get into animal behavior and jobs at shelters, for example, and humane societies, other places like that, that where you can get on-the-job training.
Yeah, it really depends on what her career goals are, I think. If she really wants to become an animal behaviorist, even though that's not a protected term and anybody can call themselves that regardless of their education or training, we technically should refer to someone who has a graduate degree in animal behavior. And we have a bias, of course, that that's the best route to go. And there are, as Dan said, a lot more programs available now. Tricia, I know, graduated from University of Wisconsin, and yep. I know her major professor, I think, has since retired, but I'm not sure if Dr. Snowden is still there or not. But if you're there in Wisconsin, I'd go talk to the people either in the zoology or biology or psychology department and see where the animal behavior courses are housed, because they can be housed in different departments depending on the institution. And I think getting the graduate training in animal behavior gives you the breadth of knowledge that other sorts of educational routes don't give you, and really connects you very well to the scientific literature and teaches you how to think critically about animal behavior so that you're in the best possible position to help pets and their people if that's the route that you want to go, or any of those other career options, as Dan said, in zoos or shelters or whatever. So that's our bias, and we hope she
and you're sticking with it.
Yeah, we're sticking to it, and wish her the best of luck.
And just at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Department of Zoology and the Department of Animal Science are both offering classes in animal behavior, and they're not in the same college. So you're right. They're you have to kind of look around a little bit to get that information. But frankly, if you contact either department, you're going to find a whole lot of information.
And, yeah. Yes. And the Animal Behavior Society meets annually. That's the professional organization that we're certified by. And they met last year in our home, not our hometown, but our home state of Boulder, Colorado. And next year they're going to be meeting out in New Jersey. So, and those meetings are open to anybody, not just members. So if she wants to come and rub elbows with some cabs and meet some people who are actually working in the field, she'd be more than happy to come to the Animal Behavior Society annual conference.
Oh, great idea. Very good idea.
Yeah, also the Animal Behavior Society has a website, animalbehaviorsociety.org, where she can find a whole lot of information, not only about graduate programs in animal behavior and the certification program, but also just about the kinds of research that's being done and other sorts of resources there. So that's a place to start.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Kathy, for that question. I want to give Michelle in Oregon a chance to join in next. Michelle, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I have two cats. We got them when they were 10 years old, and they're 12 and a half now. They're 12 and a half years old now, and they're brothers, and a litter, they're both neutered. They're males. They're indoor, and they're so sweet, so loving to us and each other. And they'll lay on the same pillow together, groom each other. But every day or every other day, one of them will get on the other one's back, bite their neck, and they'll just sit there like that for several minutes. And then they may walk away or they may start fighting and wrestling. Is that a play thing or a dominance thing? Or what's that all about?
What do you think, Suzanne? Or Dan, we'll go to you. Go ahead.
Thanks. Cats don't have a dominant sort of relationship like you might expect with some other animals. And quite often when you see those sorts of interactions, it's playful. And that would be my best guess about what's going on there. And because it sounds like the cat who's being bitten and mounted in that way is tolerating it. And so, you know, I wouldn't worry about it.
And there's the rest of their relationship seems to be pretty good. They're friendly. They don't avoid one another.
Yes, they groom each other all the time. They're very friendly with each other. So it was just curious that they do this.
Yeah, it sounds like my cats.
Okay.
they do exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
maybe and kind of
maybe like fighting because teeth are involved. But
right.
You know, for
sure.
A cat, teeth might be playful. I don't know.
Well, yeah. As long as there's no injuries involved and as long as neither cat looks like he's being negatively affected, like he's really afraid or he's screaming or he's like fighting back, like get away from me. So if, as Dan said, if they both seem to kind of tolerate this, then it just may be their form of play. The neck bite reminds me a little bit of the male biting the female during mating. And so I don't know if somehow that's got incorporated into your cat's play behaviors or not, but I would just monitor how they do with each other, and if neither seems to have a problem, then I wouldn't worry about it.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're visiting today about all kinds of animal behavior issues with our two guests, Suzanne Hetz, Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist, co-founder and president of Animal Behavior Associates Incorporated in Littleton, Colorado. Dan Estep, Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist with the same organization, Animal Behavior Associates in Littleton, also vice president and co-owner of Island Dog Press Incorporated. Great to have them with us today, and certainly you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you listening in on the Ideas Network. If you stay with us, I hope you do stay with us right up until 12:30 today. But at noon, Temple Grandin will be joining us. Temple currently works as a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She speaks around the world, literally, on both autism and working with animals, and in particular cattle handling. She's the author of several books, including The Way I See It, A Personal Look at Autism and Asperger's, and she'll be visiting Wisconsin this weekend for a couple of events, so we thought it'd be good to have her on for a little bit anyway to talk with her about her own views on working with animals. Right now, Suzanne Hetz and Dan Estep are doing a wonderful bang-up job, I might say, talking with you and with me about animal behavior. And let's see what Susan and Ringo, Wisconsin, has for us. Susan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My dilemma right now is we have a 11-year-old black lab mix that was abandoned at age 2 and adopted by my son. My son had him until May of this year when he moved out of state for work-related issues. And on Friday evening, we had a group of people, and the dog bit one of our friends in the hand, and unfortunately, the hand got infected. And so now my concern is, what are the odds of Dutch biting another person?
Was this out of the ordinary for him, or is he generally kind of edgy around people? What was the person doing, just trying to pet him, or what happened?
Yeah, we were on the living room, and then we were going out in the kitchen to have snacks, and the dog was laying in the vestibule area there, just the doorway, and our friend reached down to pet him on the head, and bam, he bit him. These people had, you know, been milling around the area for, there were 10 people. It was sort of out of the ordinary. Occasionally when you pet him on his one side, he'll kind of growl and turn his head real fast, but he's never bit anyone before.
Well, yeah, that's unfortunate. I'm sure it was very traumatizing to everybody involved. Anytime, well, based on what you've described, the first thing that I would do is to get him examined by a veterinarian.
Yeah.
Because many incidents like you describe are caused because the dog is uncomfortable or in pain. You know, an 11-year-old dog could have some arthritis. He could even have some bad teeth that when you pet him on the head, it jostles his teeth and makes him hurt. One of our colleagues, Dr. Jen Rommel, just did a whole webinar course for us on puzzling behavior changes. Could it be pain? And that can be accessed at petprowebinars.com. But that's the first thing that I would do. I would make sure that this wasn't not a primary behavior problem, but a pain problem. And your veterinarian can help you with that. After that, if there's no medical issues identified, then I would work with a professional who will help you identify some management procedures to prevent similar situations from occurring again, and also some behavior modification procedures, because once a dog shows that he's willing to bite in a particular context, he's probably going to do it again should that context or a similar context present itself. So I would not say, oh, he just had a bad day and assume that it's not going to happen again, because it probably will unless you do some sort of intervention. But my first rule out would be he's uncomfortable about something, and it could be a pain issue rather than a primary aggression problem.
There you go. Good luck, Susan. Lots to think about there. I appreciate your call very much. We have Jody in Cassville with a question as well. Jody, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question. I was listening to your response there, and I don't know if this has any correlation or not. We have a 2-year-old male golden retriever, and we have 3 kids, and our middle one is, she's 8 years old and is just the hugest animal lover. She is the most kind-hearted, gentle soul and just loves animals. And so we're kind of, I guess, questioning why our golden retriever, and she's never been anything but just loving and just loves him dearly. And the last, I don't know, several months, it seems like if she goes to pet him, he shows his teeth and acts almost like he's mad at her or something. And mm-hmm. so we can't figure out why, you know, of all the people in our house who, you know, Hannah's definitely the most kindest, I would say. And it's just in her nature to just be like that and very loving towards our animals. So I'm just kind of wondering, I mean, why he's kind of
somebody
doing that with her.
Well, if he's showing his teeth, isn't that something to be concerned about?
Absolutely. And I have one thought, and then I think Dan has some other ones. But the first thing that occurred to me as you describe, well, first thing is neither the previous caller or your particular situation, don't let anybody tell you this is a dominance problem. That's the first thing. Second thing is oftentimes children like you describe your daughter who just love the animals really a lot, like you say, and their intentions are all the best. But if, and this may or may not be true, but if she's sort of frequently trying to pet him and interact with him and, you know, always kind of focused on him, his desire to interact with her may be less than her desire to interact with him. And he may be just trying to say, hey, back off. I need some private time. You know, not so much. You're pushing me a little bit. That may be it. It may not. But that was the first picture I got in my head when you were talking. But regardless, it's certainly a situation that I think you need to get some help with, because dog bites to kids are, children are the most common targets of dog bites, and we don't want anything bad to happen to your daughter. Dan, do you want to add to that?
Right. And, you know, taking some steps right now to talk with her about this behavior and say, look, you know, you need to really pay close attention to him. And when he looks like he doesn't want you to be there, if he shows his teeth, if he begins to stiffen up, if he tries to walk away, then just simply let him. And I think if you work both with her to kind of educate her about what's going on with him and having some limits, and then also working with your dog, then I think you may very well be able to resolve all of this.
And it might be a really good idea to start some clicker training with him so that she can do a lot of interacting with him, but it's more teaching him to do things in a fun way, shaping behaviors through the clicker training, rather than maybe being sort of interactively kind of, you know, clingy and
hands
maybe
on.
Yeah, hands on more than what he wants. And Dan brought up a really good point to begin to be observant to see if he's avoiding her. Does he walk away from her a lot or try to stay away from her when she approaches him? Do you see that?
No, not always. And it seems like, I mean, she doesn't like hover over him and she doesn't hang on him and, you know,
okay.
All that. It's just like if he happens to be laying down and she walks by him, she'll just, you know, it's her nature to just crouch down and give him a little pat on the head or, you know, so it's not like she's completely overwhelming him. I don't see that at all. But so
okay.
I don't know. We'll just, you know, I guess we'll keep an eye on it. And yeah, definitely. I mean, and it's hard for her because she doesn't understand what she did, you know?
Yeah.
Well, sure. And I'd maybe get a different pattern going where maybe she carries a little treat bag. And for now, maybe for the next week or so, rather than reaching down to pet him, instead she just stays upright and drops a little treat right in front of his nose.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see if we can get him to kind of change his attitude about things with something real simple like that. And it would also be a safer interaction for her if rather than petting him, she's just dropping a little cookie down in front of his nose. And it may be that rather than sort of having the attitude, oh, here she comes again, it's like, here she comes again,
yeah.
You know, because she's got cookies. So that would be a pretty safe little exercise to experiment with, I think.
In the meantime, if she was my daughter, I would not let her alone with a dog.
For sure.
I would not. I would always be present when she's around the dog. And you agree with that, Suzanne?
I mean, absolutely.
Yes.
And I really think that any time you have a problem with it between a dog and a child, that you really need to get someone in to take an objective look at it. And management in the short term is really crucial because we don't want him to escalate that behavior to where she's going to get injured. And as in the other case, there could be a medical issue involved, although if he's only doing it with her and not when other people pet him, I think that is less likely.
Wow. Thanks again, Jody, for calling. Christy in northern Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I know we're tight on time, so I'm going to be quick. I have a 9-month-old dog. She's a couple different breeds, Border Collie, Leonberger, Black Lab, Bloodhound, sweet dog, rescue 4 months, 9 months old now. She's been in the dog crate during the day, and I have someone check on her every day, so she's 7 hours or so in the dog crate. We bike a couple miles every day off leash. I'm clicker training her, which is a real joy. Try to keep her out of the crate a few times, but I think it's separation anxiety. She kind of seems like she tips things over, goes on the countertops. There's stuff scattered downstairs. I have a unfinished basement, but the door is insulation, and she's kind of chewed some of that. And I've never had a dog with separation and anxiety. I'm not sure how to deal with it.
Well, what do we do?
She's 7 months, you said?
Nine months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just from the thumbnail description you gave me, I don't think it's separation anxiety. What she's doing is not typical of what dogs with separation anxiety do. And most dogs with separation anxiety, if you crate them, they panic. So I think she's a young dog. I mean, it sounds like you're getting her a lot of great training and exercise, but it just may be that she's not quite ready for to be loose in the house. But again, 7 hours in the crate for a young, active dog like that is really tough. And so I might try to find her a dog walker to give her a break in the middle of the day, something like that.
I, do.
I don't think it's separation anxiety.
Every day someone checks on her and walks her, yes.
Yeah.
I do have someone that checks on her during those 7 hours. She's not alone for 7 hours.
Oh.
Okay.
Good.
Okay. Well, I would start trying to leave her out of the crate for short time periods, maybe on the weekends when you're gone or evenings, so that you can acclimate her to being free in the house, and also try to find maybe a dog-proofed area of your house where she has a little bit more room to be without destroying your possessions, but she's not quite so closely confined.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Christy, for calling. Nancy on Facebook says, my neighbors let their cats go outside. They come over to my house and use my garden as a litter box, which drives my dog crazy. Any comment? We got about a minute here to talk perhaps about outdoor versus indoor cats. We keep our cats indoors. We don't let
right.
them out.
Yeah, and I think that it's the safest thing to do, certainly, because when cats are outside and unsupervised, then they can get into trouble doing things like you described, or even getting into fights with other cats. There's diseases that they can pick up and communicate to each other, and just the risks of being injured by cars and other animals. So it's safer to have the cat indoors or have the cat have outside time in some sort of supervised way or in an enclosure where the cat can be safe.
There we go.
Of those kinds of devices that are out there.
If you like the Cab Chat, hearing us Cabs chat, we now have cabchats.com where we do free chats every month and people can listen on the web.
That's wonderful. And again, your site is?
animalbehaviorassociates.com. And they can also go to sensibledogtraining.com and sign up for some free training tips and also our newsletter that has great articles about animal behavior every month.
Suzanne and Dan, will you like to come back and be with us again? I hope so. We'd love to have you back.
We'd love to. You've been great, Larry.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much. Suzanne Hetz, Dan Estep, Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist with Animal Behavior Associates. Go to my Facebook page and you can see a link right to straight to their website. We'll be back after this look at the news to talk with Temple Grandin.